It was his family-friendly roles as Danny Tanner, the sweetly neurotic father on Full House and host of America's Funniest Home Videos, that made him a household name, and his outrageously uncensored performances in HBO's Entourage and the documentary The Aristocrats have made him kind of notorious. On top of his credits as an actor, director, and irreverent stand-up, now Bob Saget can add author to his list of accomplishments. He's here to discuss his memoir, Dirty Daddy, The Chronicles of a Family Man Turned Filthy Comedian. It's published by It Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. So very pleased it has brought Bob Saget to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Do you really think of yourself as a filthy comedian, or is the title describing a shift in public perception of you since Full House?
I would say the latter. I am always saying I'm not as blue as people say, but if you look at a show like Full House, which is meant for 12-year-olds, mainly a young girl audience and family audience, that would be like a total opposite day confrontation of Jekyll and Hyde-isms.
Well, do you see your stand-up as being in the Lenny Bruce tradition?
I would like it to be one day. Lenny Bruce was breaking boundaries, and I've been more of a jokester and a punster, and a lot of my stuff has gone into nether region comedy, even though I do stories, and I'm proud of my stand-up. It's I believe it to be funny, and so do my audiences, but Lenny did some things that this book has allowed me to start exploring, which is to talk about things that are observations that mean something to me.
Well, Lenny did kind of stream of consciousness, I guess what they call the Spritz style.
Right.
You never saw the same act twice. On the other hand, George Carlin, who comes out of Lenny, was on the show a couple of times and talked about how he wrote out every joke, memorized it, and did it like an actor. Where are you in that?
I am, I guess, more of the, dare I say, the Lenny style, in that I do it like it's scat. Friends of mine know that I'm, and musician friends that I have, believe that I'm more of a jazz type stand-up, where I'll go off on a run and I'll go for a couple minutes. And George, who was also an inspiration to me, I never knew Lenny Bruce, of course, but George was someone who was very kind, and he, just like you said, I mean, he was a public speaker and a philosopher that wanted to say things exactly the same way, and he did, and
were
poignant
funny
and beautiful, and loved him.
But I guess the spontaneity is part of the thrill, although there could be a time when your mind goes totally blank and nothing funny is occurring to you.
Does that happen? Yes, that is a rough – if you're going to use that style, you better have savers to go to.
So you have certain strategies?
There are different things you do. Don Rickles was an inspiration to me when I was 17. And Don had placeholders for everything, and his act was spontaneous, and yet it had nice – standalone pieces that would – now I'm going to go into a music thing, and that's a piece of, you know, that he performs.
But Lenny Bruce did that to some degree. He had the equivalent of bullet points. When he found himself lost, he knew that he could go to a joke on that topic, and that would save him.
Did you follow him a lot?
I saw him perform many times.
And would you say he's the definable stand-up?
I think he and then a bunch of other comics who came out around that time, like Buddy Hackett and some others, they developed a new style of comedy that was not joke-based. And,
right, stories.
And, yeah, and we sit with Albert Brooks. We sit with you.
Kind to include me, thank you.
Well.
Nichols and May.
but they were written out.
They were, and there was something so special about that. I miss that.
Oh, I think however you are funny, if you could be funny, that's great.
Yes.
But are audiences still surprised when they see your onstage set?
Sometimes. More people are – the joke is out because it's been 25 years since Full House was on, even though it's on every day.
And then you did The Aristocrats.
And I did. And that was an accident just happening anyway. And that was completely a stream of consciousness idea. And I'd only heard the joke twice in my life. And I was doing it because Penn Jillette and Paul Provenza, who I knew since I was in college, wanted me to do it because they knew that I had an irreverent style, that I like to say wrong things because basically I was told not to my whole life.
Still, it must have been a little worrisome because you were, in a way, declaring that you were not the guy that everybody thought you were.
Yes, there was a bit of foot stomping going on with that. I was in my manager's office, and this is in the book that I've written, and it's a story that we tracked a couple of times. I wouldn't sign the release after I did The Aristocrats, so I went into my manager's office, and they showed us the scene. and how it was cut together. And I said, this is either going to destroy me completely or it will find a whole new audience. It did the second part.
And then, you have also gone down the middle of that. You were nominated for Grammy this year for Best Comedy Album for That's What I'm Talking About, which isn't your raunchiest material.
No, thank you.
But it breaks
what
a bit
sweater,
of...
What size sweater do you wear? I already want to start shopping for you.
It breaks a bit of a stereotype for a comedian to reminisce about his loving and supportive parents and coming from a close-knit family, because happy and well-adjusted usually isn't funny. But you do tell stories like that. On the other hand, you're featured in Kevin Pollak's documentary, which is coming out, I gather, called Misery Loves Comedy.
Yeah. He's been interviewing a lot of people on where comedy comes from, which is similar to the book I've written, Dirty Daddy, which is a lot of surviving pain was comedy. And you make a very valid point. I'll share something with you, if I may, very quickly, which is about 7 weeks ago, my mother passed away. And it was at the end of the process of making this book. And I'd worked on it a year and a half. And she was so clear the last few weeks of her life and left so happily and didn't have any pain and was just spreading love. It was a really beautiful time, actually, which we haven't had that much in our family. A lot of people don't get the good fortune of that. And what I realized was and I said this to a couple of friends of mine, if she had been like this her entire life, I probably wouldn't have been funny. I might have gone on and become a doctor or something, because I was always running to get outside of rules and her, don't use that language, Bob. Don't talk like that, Bob. And she was so elegant the last few weeks of her life. And like, if you'd have done this the whole time, I don't think I'd have a career in television.
My guest is Bob Saget, who has written a memoir called Dirty Daddy, The Chronicles of a Family Man Turned Filthy Comedian. Well, you went into comedy despite the fact that there was a lot of tragedy in your family. Maybe it was a loving family, but people kept on dying while you were growing up. And you even have a chapter called Death and Comedy Are Closely Related.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents lost 4 children during your childhood. Several close family members died young. And yet there's funny stuff in that?
That's so amazing that there is, isn't there? As you know, when you live in the sadness of it, you can stay there. And then there's nowhere to go. You can't get out of it. And my father, who passed away 8 years ago at the age of 89, was an amazing man. He was a depression child. He lost his father young. He raised 4 brothers and a sister. And his attitude was like Murphy's Law. Stuff happens, and the odds of things going wrong are pretty strong, and we're going to get through this.
Was he funny?
Incredibly funny.
So he saw humor as a way of surviving.
Totally. And it was almost denial, and then it wasn't, because he would go dark, and you would see him. You knew he was accepting things, but he had 2 heart attacks himself when he was about 40, 41, and he survived them. My mother kept him alive, and he wanted to live, and he spread a lot of love and a lot of laughter.
Well, there are a lot of people who go into different professions. You were going to become a doctor, and
that would not have been good for people.
Yeah, but let's say you had turned out to be a good doctor,
right?
Then you could still be funny with your patients, with your family,
and that depends on what kind of doctor you are. Because if you're real funny and you're examining them in any lower,
you don't want to be an oncologist.
No, you don't. I was going to go, you know me, I was going to go to proctologist, but yeah. I don't think you want to be making jokes when you're I actually had a doctor, and this won't be too much information. I'll keep it very, very proper. He was actually, it was a colonoscopy. I mean, that's going to be very brief. Mm-hmm. And he was examining me, and he asked me, did I like the new incarnation of the Star Wars movie? And I said, please don't give me a thumbs up right now on that movie. We laughed, but you really don't want your doctor to be talking to you. I'm trying to make you laugh while you're getting anxiety.
Well, I've had dentists who were very funny, but your mouth is open and you're trying to laugh at the same time.
Why do they do questions? Why do dentists do questions? We just lost a funny comedian, David Brenner, and we've been losing a bunch of people, obviously.
He was a wonderful guest as well.
He's such a lovely guy. He also went to where I went to school, Temple University in Philly, and he was a documentary major, and I knew him a little bit. And nice, it makes me happy to hear that he was in here, and he was a wonderful guest. He had a joke that was wonderful that I always remember, that he wishes there was a, when the dentist causes you pain, he wishes there was a contraption that you arrange. And this was, they told us on, I think, the Ed Sullivan Show, you put the device between the dentist's legs, and then whatever he has put, does this hurt? No, dentist, does this hurt? And he's able to reciprocate.
Now, it's... where I was leading was, it's one thing to be funny in your personal life. It's another thing to decide to make a career out of it.
True.
So what happened? Where did you go wrong?
I was 17.
Was your family shocked?
No. No, it was interesting. I used to play guitar since I was 9 and entertain the family, and nobody was really entertained by it. My parents were proud. Everybody else said, please tell Bobby to put the guitar away, please. And they would visit us in Norfolk, Virginia. And they just all left. They couldn't stand listening.
Do you remember your first jokes? Any of the jokes in your 17-year-old routine?
Nothing. I do remember my 17-year-old routines. They were non sequiturs and odd things. They were, I have the brain of a German shepherd and the body of a 16-year-old boy, and they're both in my car, and I want you to see them.
I see.
It was almost Groucho-esque kind of stuff, because he said, you have the brain of a 9-year-old, and he wants it back or something. I would say weird things like, my mother's Gumby, my father's Pokey, and I'm Mr. Potato Head. It was just odd, esoteric stuff that a young comedian around all these people that I was around, which was David Letterman and Jay Leno and Billy Crystal and Michael Keaton, they were the people I was looking at to one day achieve what they had been doing at that time. They were still at the Comedy Store and the Improv.
Well, you mentioned those people along with... Andy Kaufman and Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton was one of your inspirations.
He was a great stand-up, really great stand-up. This was before he got a show called Working Stiffs with Jim Belushi, and it was on CBS, before he was starring in a movie, before he did... I'm trying to think which one was his big one. Mr. Mom, maybe? No, it was something much bigger at the very beginning. But he had a bit... He used to do a couple things that were so wonderful. And people have stolen... Michael Keaton's bits. He'd do a bit about his arms falling asleep, and he would just stand there flailing them like it was a mink stole on a lady's shoulders, and they were just flying back and forth, and he was going, I can't wake up my arms. And a lot of people have done that piece of material, very physical stuff and very, very thoughtful stuff.
Well, you also work with Richard Pryor. Many people think that he was the funniest man ever, although what a tragic story.
Very, very.
And maybe the two are linked. Is it true that there's a thought about getting a Full House reunion together?
I don't think so. I mean, people talk about it, and people have approached John Stamos, and I don't see it happening. But there was thoughts of it happening.
Well, how did you keep that set G-rated?
Yeah, they really didn't know. It's funny. I've talked to all of the kids about it. Candace, Cameron Bure, who's on Dancing with the Stars now, kicking butt, was 9 when it started. Jody Sweetin was 4 or 5. And Ashley and Mary Kate were 9 months old when they did the pilot. And so a lot of the stuff just went over their heads, not just because of their height, but because we just tried to use other words, other vernacular, made up other things. Mm-hmm. We had a donkey on the show, and... A donkey got aroused, so I made up the name Peppermill for the donkey because it seemed...
I got it.
Okay. But that's... So we spoke in code.
Well, you are going to be in conversation with John Oliver tonight.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
That's at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. Then tomorrow with Seth Herzog at 7 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble store in Union Square. That's at 33 East 17th Street. What do you think about Letterman retiring? Do you want to be on that list?
I don't give it any thought, but it's interesting. I've over the years I've wanted to host a talk show. It's the last thing on my mind right now, but I don't think I'm in the candidacy. But I don't think she would do it. But I'd try to get Tina Fey or something. But I don't think
she's not going to take it.
No way. She's a movie star and can get done what she wants. But it'll be interesting. I love David, and I love. I mean, I know it's strange, but the Jimmys are really good, and the Jimmys.
But meanwhile, you can still do yogurt Super Bowl commercials and other things like that.
I don't know if that'll happen.
Just one more thing. You became a father while you were on Full House.
Yes.
Did that help you in playing the role?
It did.
Give you insight into being a father?
Yes. My oldest daughter is 1 year younger than the Olsen twins, and I started the show when she was a year old. And so as I was doing the show, throughout the whole run of the show, I ended up replicating the cast of the show. I mean, it was very strange. I had three daughters.
Did you come and tell the writers, hey, I have this great thing that we could do on the show?
That didn't happen a lot because I played such a clean freak on the show that I was with little Felix Unger and a little bit overly huggable. I was hugging everyone. I was a little Werner Erhard. But I was trying to just summon up love. And so that is what I did with my own family love and put that into the character.
You were a little Werner Erhard. Oh, my.
See?
Now I'm afraid of you.
Bob Saget. Scaglia? How do you say his name? Leo Scaglia? Scaglia?
I guess.
The hugger.
Yeah. Well,
I think that's, I hear my gong.
Est is est, I guess. Bob Saget is a Grammy-nominated stand-up comedian, actor, director, writer, producer, television host, and now author of a memoir called Dirty Daddy, The Chronicles of a Family Man Turned Filthy Comedian. It is published by HarperCollins, or the IT imprint. Thank you so much for being on our show.
This is a pleasure. Thanks for having me.